UK Wine Show, show number 108. Sam Harrop on winemaking faults and volatile acidity. On this week's show, we cast a spotlight into our monthly poll, what is the UK's favourite drink? And Sam Harrop gives us the latest on winemaking faults and volatile acidity with...
Just over 50% of all of the faults could be categorised as closure-related.
And in the news, £5 is key price point in the UK, and low-alcohol wine finds way round Euro ban.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 108 for the 6th of June. My, how the year's flown. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we continue talking with Sam Harrop on wine faults. Sam is a MW winemaker and an expert on all things wrong with wine, and some good ideas on what's right. We talk with Sam about the International Wine Challenge Fault Clinic, and what is the cause for many of today's wine faults. As well as we have a good old look at volatile acidity. Fault or friend? And finally, in our monthly spotlight, we look at the results from our question, what do you drink when you go out? But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. This week we're covering pricing in the UK with findings from the survey by Wine Intelligence for the Wine and Spirit Trade Association. While two-thirds of UK wine drinkers don't consider wine to be expensive, they still don't want to spend over £5 for an everyday bottle. Typically, consumers say they're happy to spend about £4.64 on a bottle for relaxing at home and £4.85 on wine for an informal supper. We checked this out with Sainsbury's, who told us that £5 is seen as a key price point, with not many wines able to sell at significant volume above this level. So how are they coping with the increases in cost of production and fuel and higher taxes and poor exchange rates? Well, they say they've tried to balance out the cost increases across the portfolio, meaning that some wines have gone up while others have stayed the same. This way they can offer a range of price points both on and off promotion. But the survey does show that the average consumer will break that £5 barrier when buying wine for certain occasions. The typical spend is about £6 on a bottle for parties or celebrations, £6.25 for a formal dinner at home, and just over £7 for wine bought as a gift. That said, according to Sainsbury's, the single most important factor determining our wine purchases is on recommendation. Chris, any comments?
I thought the Sainsbury PR speak was a bit disappointing. How do we cope with an increase in cost of production, fuel, higher taxes, poor exchange rates? Well, according to them, they've tried to balance out the cost increase across the portfolio. Gobbledygook. In other words, they've put the squeeze on their suppliers who have effectively dropped the spend on the wine in the bottle. That is, they've dropped the quality of the wine. I think it's a shame that this has happened, but it does appear to be little that can be done. I've seen prices rise quite a bit over the last 6 months. Now, we have in our wine tastings a set spend on the wine for the price per person that's attending. The result is that as the same wines are now more expensive, we're using cheaper replacements. Prices rise, and if you're not willing to pay any more, then you should expect less. In the past, improvements in technology have meant that the quality has kept up with a decrease in spend, and a wine glut has helped keep things in check. Now the question is, with such a rapid increase due to tax and exchange rates, the quality must suffer, and I believe it has. Speaking of technology, Jane, how's that spinning cone business going?
Well, some of our listeners will remember the story last year about Sauvio, the low-alcohol wine that was outlawed in the UK for being made using the spinning cone. Well, they've since found a way around the ban by sourcing the grapes from California rather than Spain. The range was withdrawn from sale in 2007 because they didn't comply with EU regulations and were made by unauthorised winemaking practices, using a spinning cone column to reduce the alcohol. But confusingly, wines made in the US using this method can be sold in Europe, and both France and Spain can also make wine using this technology for the domestic market. So, the grapes for the bottles of Sauvio wine are now coming from California, but they have had to use different grape varieties in the blend. But the labelling's still unresolved. The Wine Standards Branch wants the word reduced alcohol wine-based drink on the label, and the company is arguing that Sauvio is in fact 100% wine. But whatever the outcome, consumers can now at least buy this low-alcohol, lightly sparkling wine. It's stocked at Waitrose, and their tasting panel agreed that although it contains only 8% alcohol, its taste, flavour and body are fully comparable to conventional wines.
Cheers, Jane. This is an interesting one. On the one hand, I can see why removing a bit of alcohol is not a bad thing. Winemakers remove all sorts of things with fining agents. Fining agents are chemicals you add to the wine which react with something in the wine as they pass through it. Eventually, you rack the wine off the fining agent and what's been removed from the wine, and it's gone. Perfectly acceptable. So removing alcohol is along similar lines. But what happens if you want to increase the alcohol? A similar process in reverse is distillation. And then you have brandy. Not wine, but brandy. So it is a different product. So I can see sort of the arguments in both ways. Now, I'm not sure of the economics behind this, but you can imagine a scenario where instead of stripping alcohol out of the wine to make it a really low alcohol wine, you're doing it to save money. Imagine if you had a huge crop of wine, bigger than normal, much bigger than normal. And normally you'd land up having to wait quite a bit to allow the full flavour to ripen. But as a result, your sugar levels go wildly high. Let's say 16, 17, even 18%. And assuming that you can get the yeast to chew up all that sugar, you're left with a very high alcohol wine, but quite cheap. I think the key thing here is you could possibly decrease your cost of production with these big crops and get around the high taxes that start kicking in at about 15.5% by using a spinning cone. So a spinning cone could be used for all sorts of things, not just producing low alcohol wines. One country that doesn't need to worry much about high alcohol wines is Austria. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, our final story is a bit of a plug for Austrian wines, and in particular, Grüner Veltliner. In spite of the fact that exports of Austrian wines were up 30% last year, growth in the UK is being limited. And according to the Austrian Wine Marketing Board, it's because we British think of Austria as a place for skiing and the sound of music as opposed to wine. We just can't get our heads around the fact that they produce wine. But we are importing more of the country's wine, but only a fraction of the country's total exports. The UK imported 211,000 litres last year against total exports of 56 million litres. Germany imported the most, taking nearly 40 million. 95% of the wine coming to the UK is white wine, but often in store the wine sits alongside Eastern European wines and people just can't find it. So next time you're shopping, look out for Grüner Veltliner. It's Austria's flagship grape and one of the best food wines around. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can get more detail on these stories at our news homepage at 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Sainsbury's Grüner is not a bad drop and fairly well priced if you're looking for something decent and cheap. But I wonder how popular it really is, especially given that our poll we ran last week shows that wine is easily the drink of choice. In fact, let's get stuck into this week's spotlight. This week, the poll question from last month was, which of the following do you prefer to drink when going out? Well, beer got 22%, cider got 2%, others got 1%, I'm not quite sure what they were drinking there. Spirit-based drinks or cocktails, 12%, but still and sparkling wine came in at a massive 63%. Now, beer and wine appear to be the two most popular drinks from most people, and it's not surprising that wine is doing so well, particularly given that the poll was run on a wine website and at wine tastings. But even so, it still dominates the drinks business. Cider is considerably less than I had expected, given the huge push that the cider business has been undertaking over the last couple of years, and especially when you consider that cider is generally available in pubs on tap. As a non-spirits drinker, apart from the odd whiskey and cognac, I was really surprised by the level of spirit and cocktail drinkers out there. That pretty much ends this week's spotlight, and it's good to see that wine is a popular drink. Next week, we have a book review. Now, hopefully I'm going to be interviewing David Harvey's Grapes of Britain, but due to a few mistakes by the publishers, Neil Wilson Publishing, it hasn't arrived yet. So if it arrives in time for the review, we'll get into that. Otherwise, I've got another book up my sleeve, so we'll just see what comes out. And speaking of next week, we will be concluding our look at wine faults with Sam Harrop. And hopefully, if Sam has managed to finish the full analysis of the 2008 International Wine Challenge results, rather than wee snippets we have in this week's show, we'll be able to give you a bit more information about that. But this week, the focus is on bottling issues and volatile acidity. Friend or enemy? Let's have a listen to what Sam has to say. Hi, I'm here with Sam Harrop, MW, and co-chair of the IWC and expert on faults. How are you, Sam?
I'm very well, thanks.
Excellent. Just a quick question about some of the faults that you're getting at the IWC. We're going to talk a wee bit about volatile acidity today as well.
Yeah, well, we've been doing a lot of hard work on faults here and got some fascinating results. You know, the most important thing we've found is that cork taint is not the only fault. And a lot of people might have you believe that it is the only fault. There are a lot of faults due to winemaking, which seems to be a serious trend, which we're going to be releasing in our faults report within the next couple of months. Effectively, winemakers need to smarten up their game. And winemakers in particular in the old world need to smarten up their game, bottle wines in a stable condition, free from these other faults that we classify into sulfides, oxidation, Brettanomyces, you know, rot, which is actually inherent in the fruit. Believe it or not, we're seeing wines coming through showing these horrible dusty grey rot characters. So it's not just about TCA. You know, what we've found in 2006 and 2007, over 50% of just over 50% of all of the faults could be categorized as closure-related. That's not all cork taint, by the way. We found that of all faults recorded, 28% roughly in both years were due to TCA, i.e. cork taint.
Yep.
So there's another 20-odd percent coming from closures. So what are they? Screw cap reduction is one of them, and also reduction from cork as well. So the closure is obviously important in this faults discussion, faults debate, but it's not all important. The other winemaking faults, as we classify them, take up the other 50%. So although in the past winemakers have blamed the poor old cork manufacturers for any kind of fault in their wine, those days are numbered. I'm certainly not sympathising with the cork manufacturers. They've got a lot of work to do to improve the cork quality. You know, that's still a major issue. As I've said before, 3% of all wines tasted at the International Wine Challenge, 3% of all wines sealed with natural closure, I should say, are affected by cork taint. That's
yep.
a huge amount. That's 3 million bottles, corked bottles in the UK alone. Actually, no, it's more than that. Whatever, you get the scale of the size of the problem. Now, so the other type of fault under winemaking faults are microbial faults. As I said before, Brettanomyces, bacterial faults. We're seeing some lactic acid, putrescine characters coming
What's
through.
What's putrescine?
That's a compound that's generated by various bacterium that has a disagreeable aroma of sick, unfortunately. It's not
baby vomit.
Baby vomit, you got it.
I know that smell.
Certain yeast can produce it as well. It's not a lovely character.
Some wines with low minerality seem to have that as well.
Well, your point about minerality raises a lot of questions. What is minerality? You know, is it sulfides? Is it Brett? Is it putrescine? God help us.
Is it the stones in the ground?
Is it the stones in the ground?
Don't think so.
The winemakers would have you believe that, and certainly in the old world. Well, that's another debate, really, but it does raise the great point of where does a fault become a complexing factor, and this is why I'm so fascinated in faults and why I want to understand the extent of faults throughout the industry and then educate those faults to the consumer.
So you got putrescine effects, microbial faults?
Yeah, and then under chemical faults, well, there's the oxidation and chemical sulfide faults.
How common is oxidation issues?
Yeah, we've seen quite a bit of it, actually. Well over 15% of the total faults recorded are oxidation.
Yep.
Related. Some of those are due to inadequate natural corks, you know, because natural cork has varying elasticity.
Yep.
One bottle is not the same as the next. Unlike screw cap, it's not a technical closure. So it can be linked to the closure, but more importantly, I think the bigger issue is people are actually bottling wines in an oxidized state or bottling the wines with very low levels of sulfur dioxide, so they oxidize quickly, which is a serious issue. You know, wines have to be bottled in a stable condition. That, you know, the real reason for all of this faults analysis is to share it with the industry, to educate the industry that it's not just cork taint. Winemaking issues are huge as well. So smarten up your act. pay a little bit more attention at bottling. A lot of winemakers, believe it or not, spend a huge amount of effort, blood, sweat and tears making the best wines in the world, and then they hand it over to the production manager for bottling, you know, and walk away.
What about issues like bulk importing of wine where it's bottled in the country? Like, some winemakers say, no, I don't want to do bulk importing, but from an environmental point of view, particularly in the UK, bulk importing is quite a good thing.
Carbon footprint.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Do you think that they shouldn't be bulk imported because you need to have control over that bottling, or can you prep the wine before you ship it over?
I think the answer to that is it's a difficult question to answer, I should say. I don't think there's any one answer. I think if it's a commercial product, a fruit-driven sort of 499 product for supermarkets, there is a strong case to be bottled in the UK. As you said, environmentally, it seems to be more sound, less carbon emission. But you have to be, the winemaker at both ends has to be very careful in the preparation of those wines. And so perhaps in the instance of fruit-driven wine, sulfur dioxide levels should be a little higher than they would normally store in their own tanks. They lose control, effectively. When the wine gets shipped, even though it's in a giant-sized tank, or, you know, effectively they lose control of it. And, you know, supposedly a lot of these tankers are insulated and the temperature doesn't vary greatly. But, there have been examples where wines have got too hot, where wines haven't been filtered properly, where the sulfur levels haven't been high enough and the wines arrive oxidized. Just the other day I was talking to a buddy in Russia who imported some bulk wine and it turned up oxidized. So it can be a good thing. It can be a great thing if you've got a competent winemaker at the winery side and a competent winemaker at the bottling side who knows how to prepare the wine on arrival for bottling. That's traditionally been an issue with the UK wine industry, is that it's not a winemaking... There's not a winemaking mentality in the UK. Although there is a lot of wineries and it is a growing sector, there hasn't been an understanding truly how to bottle wines properly. It's more of a sort of food technician's approach.
Yeah, sure.
And they've learned a lot over the last few years. But I guess what I'm saying is that winemakers over here who have been bottling bulk for Australians and New Zealanders haven't necessarily had the same approach to quality as the winemaker at bottling as the winemakers in New Zealand and Australia. So that needs to be resolved. And then just to answer the other part, in terms of premium wines, there's no question the wine needs to be bottled at the site, at the winery.
Okay.
You know, because that's where the winemaker needs to be really involved in the wine bottling process, not just handing it over to his trusted production manager, because he or she should be taking a real vested interest in that bottling process to make sure it's bottled in a stable condition for the consumer.
Okay. Any other faults?
No, I mean, that's pretty much it. It's just really opening up a can of worms, really. And I just really wanted to emphasize the importance we're placing on winemaking faults. It's not just about closure. Closure is a huge issue, but winemaking is also a massive issue, and it seems to be becoming more of an issue over the 3 years we've done it. You know, this year, 2008, seems to be... winemaking problems seem to be a bigger issue than in the past, so it's not getting any better, put it that way.
A fault that I quite often, I get in some wines, but not, I'm particularly not as sensitive as some people, is volatile acidity. What is volatile acidity and what should you be looking for, and is it a good thing or a bad thing?
I talked about oxidation just before.
Yep.
Yeah, volatile acidity is generally a bit of a signpost for oxidation. Volatile acidity is... it gives you this sort of sensory quality of a bruised apple, if you like. Okay, picture this. You bite into a fresh apple. You then just leave it on your bench, your kitchen bench on a hot summer's day. Leave it there for 20 minutes. Come back and just smell the apple. That is, to me, classic volatile acidity aroma. And that's an extreme version. So I always use the term sort of bruised apple when talking about volatile acidity. Now, in certain levels, though, you'd be surprised it can actually enhance the complexity. It
gives a lift to the wine.
It does, yeah. You know, ethyl acetate is a volatile acid, effectively. And, well, look, ethyl acetate is a compound very common in wines made with maceration carbonate. approach. You know, Gamay from Beaujolais.
Yeah. Beaujolais is the cabinet
administration. So it's not all evil, but we're once again coming back to my philosophy, and it balances everything. It's in certain styles, volatile acidity can add complexity, can enhance the aromatic profile, can lift the wine. High tone characters can lift the aromas, but it's all about balance.
Not, you said high tone, not ketone. High tone.
I use the term high tone.
Are they ketones?
No, no.
So not my sixth form chemistry is not quite showing.
No, when I say high tones, that's no chemical term. That's just a tone.
It's a high note.
Exactly, it's part of my vocabulary. Yeah. But it lifts the aroma, as you say.
See, I always thought a wee bit of VA is quite good, but it comes off the wine pretty quick, doesn't it? Like you get VA and it just boils off and then it's gone. Is that right, or have I got it wrong?
Yeah, as the wine opens up, and the reduction, you know, the wine gets more air and the fruit comes out with a bit more oxygen as it's decanted or whatever. You see these other fruit flavors coming through, other tertiary notes coming through to support the volatile acidity. So maybe it's not so much that the VA is blowing off; it's just that other flavors are coming through and creating a marriage with the VA.
Because I have noticed VA, particularly things like old wines like Barolos and things like that, when you first open them up, you get a real chunk of that high note, what I associate with VA, and then after 10, 20 minutes, I don't really notice it again. Is it?
Well, they are high, you know, the term volatile is quite self-explanatory. They are unstable and they do seem to dissipate quite quickly, you're right. But there's also this other factor with other flavors, fruit flavors and tertiary flavors being released as more oxygen comes in. So for me, there's it's a bit of both, volatile acidity being blown off, but also the fruit coming through and joining it and muting the volatile acidity.
I seem to get the impression that it's more common with older wines that have been aged. Is that true, or?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at Pinot Noir from Burgundy, you know, young Pinot Noirs from Burgundy, some of the best examples have really high volatile acidities, you know. Basically, the higher the riper the fruit at harvest, the more sugar, obviously. And if we come back to my point before, the yeast can be stressed in high sugar or high alcohol environment. So at the end of fermentation, volatile acidity levels can dramatically increase because the yeast is struggling in these high alcohol environment.
Struggling yeast produce more sulfur and more volatile acidity
as well. I should have mentioned that earlier. So it's not just older wines. Come back to your point. It's more and more we're seeing volatile acidity, higher volatile acidity in younger wines as well.
How does it develop? Is it a case that older wines have it because of the aging process, and that some wines because of the fruit levels, younger wines have got it, or is it? It's nothing to do with age of the wine. It doesn't develop in the bottle or anything like that. It's just there or not there.
I think, like all of these faulty compounds, they certainly evolve. They have a tertiary expression themselves. But they do generally get a little more extreme. But you can't consider the compound in isolation. There are these other flavors and other compounds evolving and going into their tertiary expression as well. And I think it's wrong to generalize that volatile acidity will eventually destroy a wine. If a wine is bottled with a certain level of volatile acidity, perhaps, you know, 0.7, 0.8 grams per liter, which is on the higher side of things, it's not necessarily going to, you know, mean the wine is, when it's open in 5-6 years' time, is a disaster. You know, because it depends on the redox potential of the wine, it depends on the inherent quality and stability of the wine, and how the pH, for example, how it's going to age, and how the fruit and reductive flavors are going to be released as the wine ages. So, does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think you're saying it's quite complicated.
It is quite complicated. It's hugely complicated. And it comes back to this point again. I sound like a scratch record, sorry, but it's, you know, faults can be fantastic at the right level. It's very difficult to generalize.
Okay, Sam. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. I certainly hope you enjoyed that interview with Sam. These shows have been a bit full on and a wee bit technical, but I learnt loads when I spoke to Sam about it, and re-listening to the interviews has helped me cement it into my brain. As I said, next week we're going to be doing a book review, and Sam finishes off with Brettanomyces, yeast that's gone bad. As we've been doing over the last couple of weeks, we finish up with a wee joke. So hopefully you're laughing at them. Here it is. An old Englishman walks into a bar and asks for a bottle of 38 wine from Lyon, France. The bartender, not wanting to go into the cellar, gave the Englishman the closest bottle of wine he had at hand. The Englishman tasted it and said, "This wine is only 2 years old and is from Santiago, Chile." The bartender was amazed, but at the same time curious. So he gave him another bottle. The Englishman goes, "This wine is 17 years old and from San Diego, California." The bartender was amazed, so he gave him another bottle. "This wine's a 30-year-old from Lima, Peru." Finally, the barman goes into the cellar and got the right bottle of wine. The Englishman said, "Finally, a 38-year-old wine from Lyon, France." An old drunk who'd been watching goes up to the Englishman and said, "Could you please tell me what kind of drink this is?" and hands him a cup. The old Englishman tasted it and said, "What the heck is this pee?" The drunk replied, "Yeah, I know it's pee, but please, can you tell me where it's from? I can't remember where I live." Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.